cliffcentral.com.
Jesse Clegg is here, and I got to see him performing live on Saturday at his dad's farewell concert in Johannesburg, which was spectacular. God, you two made me cry like a baby.
Yeah, man, it's been a very emotional journey, this tour. We were both kind of teary-eyed. Every time we play together, it's intense. It's really meaningful, so I'm glad that it translates.
Well, it does, and your dad tells the story about how you used to say to him, look, you know, we got to stay away from each other. I'm not going to be involved in your songs. You're not going to be involved in mine. Because it's hard in a music career when you kind of, you're almost always going to be perceived by some people as being Johnny Clegg's kid. And by others, they don't know who Johnny Clegg is. They're fans of yours.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's nice when the two mix.
Yeah. I mean, you know, me and my dad have always been very close. Mm. And my creative ego as an artist has nothing to do with my relationship with my dad.
No,
you know,
no.
I'm really close, and we hang out all the time. But as an artist, you know, I've been doing this 9 years now, and you know, I want to find my own voice and find my own sort of direction. And it's been weird, you know, the last few years I've kind of spent a lot of time trying to disassociate, and just, you know, in the last year and a half since my dad's health thing that happened. You know, it's amazing how it kind of just, it's a great equalizer, you know, it just kind of makes you reevaluate.
Prioritizes everything.
You just start thinking like, you know what, I'm doing this because I actually really want to. And I really want to be on stage.
I think you've got such a unique sound, and yours is so different to your dad's sound.
Yeah.
And the two of you, I mean, I'm certainly not of the opinion that the two of you, that there's a huge overlap of similarity.
So
from that point of view, you know, you say creative ego. I don't know that either of you massively egotistical people.
No.
There's certainly a pride in what you've created from your side, and your dad is tremendously proud of you. And similarly, you're proud of him. So it's just nice that there's this.
Yeah,
it's
working. Nice that it can all overlap at some point, you know, and that when this final journey tour and my dad's album, which I was actually kind of producing, I was working on him with, we've never really done that before. You know, I always kind of try to do my own thing, and this year has just been incredible. It's been, we've all kind of bunched together, and kind of it just felt like this family, and this on a professional and on a personal side, you know?
Well, that song I've Been Looking is magic.
Thank you, man.
It really is. You wrote that.
Yeah,
it's a beautiful song. I mean, that's really, it's a standalone something worth seeing. If you go to the concert, you'll see a lot of the old kind of classics. You'll see you doing some of your stuff, but for me, that song is worth the trip, even if you don't see anything else. It's really beautifully done, and the two of you have such an interesting kind of, you said overlap, that's the word for it, in that. And then I think you did Great Heart as well together, which I mean, just that for me is it's like the magnum opus, right?
It's an honor, man. And I mean, that song, you know, I had that song for a while. I wrote it about a year and a half ago, but I didn't finish it. And I brought it into the studio, and I played it for my dad, and he just said, "This is incredible. You know, let me help finish it. Let me put some lyrics in, and you know, we can."
Was your first impulse to go, "No, no, 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 no"?
I was keeping that song, man. I was holding on to that thing, and then you know, I knew that he would like it, and I knew that he it just resonated, because I wrote it during, when we were kind of going through all the realizations and stuff.
Yeah.
So it just made a lot of sense, and it came out really nicely, man. It's I'm really proud of it.
Well, listen, I mean, you guys are a tight family, and you know, your dad put up a couple of the videos that Jared's done as well.
Yeah.
Which is spectacular. That music video that he made with the whole kind of spaceship.
Yeah, it's incredible.
It's brilliant.
The Hope of Africa, man. I love it. It's so beautiful.
And I loved that. And then, you know, you see kind of your mom on social media as well. It's just really, it's really sweet to see this, because I think for a lot of people in South Africa, a lot of people grew up without their dads, without their moms. Maybe they're not close nuclear families. So it's nice to see when that does happen, and when it does work, how you guys kind of are there for each other. And I mean, when things get tough, and obviously when you have health issues and fucking cancer, man.
Yeah. It sucks.
When that comes up.
God.
Yeah, it really does. But it's really nice that you guys can kind of hold on to each other.
Yeah. I mean, we've always been very close, and it's something that's rare in this industry specifically. You know, I don't see a lot of close families that are still integrated and are still kind of functional.
Mm.
Among my peers and among my
musicians
friends,
usually come from these horrible broken homes. They've got horrible lives.
And so it's a rarity. And I really must say, you know, my dad and my mom have created a special space for our family. You know, we've always felt like there's career and there's the art and all this stuff, but there's a very special kind of little insular place that we all share together, which is very private and very personal, and it's really been something that's only kind of gotten stronger in the last few years. So I'm very fortunate.
How much of your dad's being Zulu comes through to you? I mean, how much of that did he include you guys in?
Well, we went to Zululand fairly often growing up.
For him, he came in here the other day, and we had about an hour and a half to talk, and I mean, he blew my mind. He gets into it, and you can just see it's like in his DNA.
I know, he loves it.
This is not some, you know, there are a lot of people who pretend that they're multicultural and that they're interested in other cultures, and they've got this kind of curiosity. Yeah. Oh, I go to Thailand, and I love the food. Your dad is like,
he is more deep, Zulu than anything else.
He's deep, dude. So when he was raising you guys, when you were growing up with him as a dad, did he like speak Zulu to you? Did he take you to places? Did he introduce you to people?
He did.
Or was
I mean,
it sort
we,
of let them find their own way.
There was, we definitely felt a sense of independence. He didn't want to force anything on us. I regret that he didn't expose us to more. But we did have a lot of, we had much more than the average white person, for example, in South Africa. We were down in Zululand every two or three weeks at Sipho's place. At ceremonies, you know, hanging out with his family. And I mean, he's got, you know, 53 kids and 9 wives. And so it's like being in a commune at his place, you know. So, and he's not even the most within his district. The chief has over 100. So, but, and you know, a lot of my dad's friends, were a huge part of my childhood, you know, like almost my uncle, like what Zulus would consider your uncle or your father, your father's friend or your father's brother in a way.
Right.
And so, you know, I had a lot of mentors growing up who were traditional people. Sipho included. I mean, Sipho is like, geez, he's like my dad. You know, I've known him since I was born. So I think just from a interpersonal level and just learning the values and learning the worldview, and I think that's what my dad is so good at, is beyond the exoticness of the culture, if someone's not actually exposed to it, there is a very valuable lesson to be learned from the worldview of Zulu people. You know, there's a lot of deep connection to family, deep connection to phases in life, and how you have to take care of your responsibilities and how you have to respect your elders and each
and
phase.
Becoming a man.
Yeah, and becoming a man and what it means to be a man and who, you know, who you are in the world and in relation to your community. And I think those are lessons that are valuable in any culture, actually.
Sure.
And I think that's something that my dad really has passed down to us.
How much of the social anthropology stuff did he give you, like history lessons when you were little? Because I've got 2 nephews.
Yeah.
And I know my brother and sister-in-law are not going to spend any time talking to them about history. So I know it's going to be my job. But when you love history as much as I do, and I know your dad does too, there's an inclination to kind of try to pass on as much of that knowledge to your kids as possible.
Yeah.
Did he, first of all, do you have an interest?
Yeah.
Second of all, if you did have an interest, did he kind of feed it?
Yeah, he definitely did. I mean, he was a lecturer for 10 years.
Yeah.
So our family has a very deep appreciation for academia.
Yeah.
You know, I did 2 degrees at WITS, and then I studied at University of Toronto.
What are your degrees?
I did a BA Law and English Literature, and then I did an honors degree in English Literature. And I did anthropology, I did politics, I did philosophy as well. And I think that, you know, my dad gave us context in history, mm-hmm. but he also gave us an appreciation for the discipline of academia as well, just in terms of training your mind, expanding your horizons, challenging your assumptions at all times, you know, and placing your own views within a greater trajectory.
Context.
Yeah, context. I think that's very important. And, you know, he knows like cryptic, obscure African history that, I mean, you can't even find. I mean, I've studied African literature and I've studied it at university, and there's stuff that he knows that, I mean, not even a lot of Zulu people know, you know. Yeah. So he's got deep, deep knowledge of this country, both the official history and unofficial. So it's I mean, it's fascinating. I really enjoy it.
I'm curious also, you studied stuff that normally, if you were going to end up a musician, you wouldn't necessarily study. I mean,
yeah.
Law, sure, it helps, you know. And obviously, in every aspect of life, you're going to draw on a little bit of law, a little bit of commerce, a little bit of language. But in this case, it could have been, and I'm sure for many musicians, and particularly the kids who grow up with a father for a musician or a mother for a musician, they don't pay attention to that stuff because you think, oh, well, my talent will be enough.
I was very suspicious of going into music initially. You know, I saw the power of music, the incredible ability for music to connect people, but I also saw the lifestyle. I saw the discipline it takes. I mean, we as a family, it was tough on us. You know, my dad would be away for 9 months of the year, so I knew what I was getting into. I was disillusioned straight away.
Right.
And I mean, it's intimidating, man. It's difficult to take it on with the legacy, you know. So I enjoyed academia. I miss it. I mean, I graduated about two years ago and I really miss it. I really got a lot of value out of it. And I was going to be a lawyer, you know. So, and then my album went platinum. So then I was like, okay, well, maybe I can do this.
Dude, I studied law and I just knew it wasn't going to be my career.
I have so many friends who I studied with and are now working and they are hating it. They're like, they're all doing other things. They all have law degrees and they go out and branch into something else. You
well,
know?
It is, law can be a bit of a hold-all degree though, but I'm interested in the English literature.
That I really enjoyed. That was fascinating.
What sort
man.
Of stuff did you do there?
I did my thesis on, my thesis I actually did in Toronto when I was recording my second album.
Yeah?
I did it on Darwin in literature.
Oh, wow.
So you study the origin of the species
as a
piece of literature, not as a science text, because it's actually beautifully written, man. I mean, it's like reading poetry, because in the 1800s, he didn't have the language yet to actually write it in formal hard science. So when you read the first edition of The Origin of the Species, it is like this tribute to nature. It's just a guy who's in love with nature and figuring out this incredible symmetry. And he traces it through each chapter, and it's just this like, it's such a passionately written text. It's beautiful. And then you read.
Can you believe how he suffered to get that published?
And he was very religious, man.
Big time. He felt a major clash inside of him between the scientist and the religious man.
He held onto it for 20 years before he actually released it. And the only reason he released it is because there was another guy who started to stumble on it and started to publish papers about it as well.
That's right.
And then he released it just to kind of preempt it. But so I wrote my thesis on that and on 18th century science fiction that based their ideas off of what Darwin is just starting to discover and how they thought evolution might work. And they wrote these crazy weird like science fiction novels about people becoming animals and then turning into
sort of almost in that Dr. Moreau.
Yeah,
kind of
Dr. Moreau was one of the texts. So you know, it was very interesting and I really enjoyed it. So and
that's
it also
that's
informed,
amazing. That's
yeah,
fantastic,
fantastic
stuff.
Yeah, fantastic.
So you got totally immersed in that, despite the fact that you were busy producing an album at the same
time.
Totally, man. I've read something just recently that's quite interesting that gives credit to Darwin for being the single greatest emancipator of humankind by showing us how kindred we are with the animals.
Yeah.
To show us that we're part of this big picture of nature, that we're not separate from it.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of religion tries to make us a separate thing, that we were almost created on another day and we're not part of nature.
Yeah.
We're sort of somehow between God and nature. Actually, with evolution and the origin of species and, you know, natural selection and all of that stuff, we found ourselves to be closer to, you know, first of all, the other animals, and then even the DNA we share with bananas.
Yeah, exactly.
And nuts.
and the genius of nature, you know, it gives you a respect for how intelligent and how intelligent is not the wrong word, but the symmetry and the way that these systems work is beautiful. It's just beautiful, you know. And for me, it's a wonderful story of a guy who stumbled upon this great truth and battled to find a way to tell the world. And when he did, it literally changed the world forever, you know.
And I mean, to be sailing around the world on that beagle and stopping in the Galapagos in places where people had not been. And then to observe all these different species of finch and compare their beaks. And I mean, this is stuff that you have to have such a deep and abiding passion for. There's just, I don't know if anybody these days is able to focus for long enough with social media and mobile phones and everything else with the kind of clarity that he focused on this.
Yeah, he wrote a tome, like volumes, on a mollusk that was on the beach by his house, and he studied this thing because it had the ability to change genders. It was sort of gender fluid, and the way that it reproduced was it didn't need another mate, so it was kind of I don't know what the word is, but it kind of reproduced independently,
almost like a hermaphrodite.
Yeah, and he studied this thing for like 10 years, man, on a mollusk, like thousands of pages. So I mean, the discipline was just incredible, and you know, so. It's just I just got wrapped up in it, and I wrote a very long thing on it. So.
Wow!
I really enjoyed it.
I think that's amazing to have studied Darwin, but from the point of view of it being beautiful literature.
Yeah, you should read it, man. It's actually really entertaining.
I've never actually read the original stuff. I've always read scientific stuff that uses it as its basis or quotes from it. But
and it was criticized for not being written in hard science language. It was very very aesthetically
florid.
And he wrote it as a sort of like an ode to nature. It was beautiful. The first edition, you have to find that one. It's hard to find.
is that something you would love to actually see? I think they've got it in the British Library or something.
Yeah, I've got it at home.
You've got a first edition?
Yeah, not first edition in terms
of first translation.
The first version,
sure.
Yeah. There's 9 versions of The Origin of the Species. And he kept on kind of honing it in and making it more formal science language.
How did you come to that? How did you decide that?
I've always had an interest. I mean, I enjoy science and I enjoy I enjoy 18th century literature as well, so it kind of combined the two. But this course was only offered in the University of Toronto, and the lecturer was an incredible guy. He was one of the most profound lecturers I've ever had, and I just took it and I was like, let's see if I'm going to enjoy this.
You're such a contradiction, because you like grunge music and then you like this, and it's just such a weird mix up of stuff.
Yeah,
you really are. You're interesting. I mean, that's a compliment.
Thank you.
As a compliment.
Yeah,
because a lot of people want to put us into boxes of being he's a musician,
yeah,
and that's all he knows, and that's all I can ever talk to him about is music.
Yeah And I think that as a student, a lot of the books that I was reading was very much informing my writing. I wrote a song on my second album called Winston, which is the main character of 1984, and it's
George Orwell.
Yeah, and I studied that book and I loved it, and I wrote a song for the character. So it's very, my second album is very literary.
I do think that's spectacularly incisive too, because these days you're almost drawn more to Orwell than I feel. You know, it's been relevant almost at every time in human history. But when we look at what's going on in America with Trump, and if we see what's going on here in South Africa with this current regime and all of the other stuff. And I mean, this is where, again, I hate to do this to you, but I'm going to have to draw your dad into this, because he was always very sentient about these things.
Yeah.
And I suppose if you're reading Orwell and if you're referencing Orwell in your songs, it may go over many people's heads.
Yeah.
But for you, it gives meat to the music, right?
Yeah. And again, like the what I loved about that book is that it makes this situation personal. It's about a guy dealing with, you know, a free man in an unfree society. And yeah, I mean, you know, it's so important right now to hold on to those ideas, because all the deceptions that those authoritarian societies are prone to, we are seeing now in a far more complex way, in a far more layered way, with the internet, with the way information is
Bell Pottinger.
Yeah, exactly, man. And you know, stuff. Fake news, and how social media is, how ideas just suddenly become catalysts for something, and they're not even based on anything. You know, it's terrifying. And you know, Orwell saw it before the internet. You know, he knew that there was going to be a way that information could get controlled, and truth becomes this relative term. So yeah, it's terrifying.
How do you know you're free? I mean, do you ever think about that?
Jeez. Yeah. I mean, it depends how far you want to zoom out. Free in society, or free within yourself, or, you know,
start with you. How do you know in your day-to-day life that you are, you know, let's say half or more free?
I mean, I guess based on your ability to make decisions, to change the direction of your life inherently, to destroy it if you want, I guess, or build it up. You know, I think on your daily choices that you make, and your ability, I mean, it's hard to say, because also your sense of your worldview is determined by how many ideas you've actually been exposed to, how much education you've had, how much exposure you've had to different worldviews and different ways of seeing the world. And if you are just locked into one sort of line, then you're not free. You know, you don't have the capacity to envision your life in another way.
And in particular, to hear things that are unwelcome to you.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of people go through their life thinking that that freedom is for them to not have to confront things that you're not comfortable with.
Yeah.
And I see
self-awareness, man.
Yeah.
That's a deep freedom, and it's difficult. I mean, that freedom is a burden, you know, and the ability to interrogate your own assumptions in a deep way, and actually, and admit that you're wrong sometimes. That's really a personal freedom that's you have to be strong to deal with, you know. Freedom is not, freedom isn't free, you know. It's a responsibility.
Do you have friends that you have these conversations with, or is it mostly like, you know, you're a bit of a star, so you have friends who kind of look up to you and imagine that they have proximity to,
I mean, I have a lot of
talent and success, and that's good enough for them.
You know, I've had the same kind of best friends since I was in high school. I'm not really someone who is a socialite. I don't really have, you know, hundreds of.
Yeah, what do you do for fun?
I usually just like sit at home and play with my cats or something. You know, play video games, have a braai. But like, I have my musician friends who are my, you know, we talk about music.
I saw you at the concert. You were hanging with, obviously, a lot of these guys are kind of halfway between you and your dad in terms of generation. But, you know, Ross from Prime Circle and Art Matthews and
Arno
and Khan.
I look up to these guys. You know, I've listened to their music for years. So
listen, that's something I realized at this concert. I had a little epiphany. I was like, these are the greatest musicians of the 2000s in South Africa.
Yeah.
I mean, to see those guys up there doing their thing, they were obviously paying tribute to your dad because they've all looked up to him the way you just said you looked up to them. It was spectacular to have all of them on the stage at the same event, really just doing it to be a part of your dad's kind of tour.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then seeing you with them, they all had so much fun.
Yeah,
great. They were all enjoying it so much. People loved to hear them.
No, it was a really, really nice vibe, especially coming back from America, and you kind of get welcomed back by, you know, your peers and your community. And it was just
this. Is there a community in South African music?
There has started. One has started in the last 2 years. I think before that, there was always this kind of distance between all the artists. But I think that for some reason in the last 2 years, like everyone's just chilled out a lot. You know, we all kind of see each other, and you know, it's unavoidable. It's not that big an industry. It's kind of the same faces every weekend at any given festival. And yeah, it is a nice community, man. I mean, I'm good friends with a lot of musicians, you know, and it's nice to speak to your peers and see what their experience is and get advice and give advice, you know. So I think that the more of that happens in the South African industry, the better. You know, the more cross-pollination we have between different artists from different genres, we're all chatting and just openly sharing. I think that's such a good thing, man.
Yeah. Sorry, I sort of diverted you down the musician when you were busy describing your friends. You said you've got friends who are musicians.
Yeah, you know, I also have my Wits friends who love these debates. You know, they love talking about freedom and politics and literature, and you know, and that's another little kind of social community that I enjoy. So you know, I kind of straddle those two worlds.
Yeah, but
worlds.
You can't box anybody. If you get to know them well enough, you realize that they're interested in a bunch of different things, and that's what makes us all interesting if you're just prepared to take the time.
Absolutely, man. Yeah. I mean, I've had some of the most intellectual conversations with musicians who have no academia background, and I've had very lame conversations with professors, you know. So it really depends. And
do you think about your legacy? I mean, especially now while you're taking in your dad's, and I got to say, it's a privilege to be around to see his career making this beautiful circle.
Mm.
You know, he's now able to do what very few musicians can, and that is to tidily and beautifully wrap a bow around it and say, this is my career now. If I carry on living for 100 years or if I live for five, this is what I want my musical career to have represented. And to see that evolution is just spectacular, because you also get a grasp of how momentous his career has been. Do you think about legacy?
I do. I don't think I think about it in my own personal life. I feel grateful that I've written songs that I think will be important to someone for a long time. I think that's a very special connection to have.
Just talk to me about that for a second, because that is something I'm very jealous of. No, it's insanely. To be able to write music, I've said to you before, we've had an interview before, we've discussed this. To be able to write music and to know that a song that you are putting together, that it's a unique creation of yours.
Yeah, it's weird, man.
It lives forever.
Yeah. It's, you know, I think that the most visceral connection you can have with someone through art is not even meeting them or signing an autograph or whatever. It's if they hear your song and it brings them back to a time in their life or an experience they had, or, you know, they hear that song in it and they can remember someone or something, you know, that then your perspective or your sort of expression has become kind of linked to their life. You kind of like this link in their chain, you know, and
integrate into them.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing, man. It's really beautiful. That's the power of
I
music.
Mean, do you have people say to you, oh, you know, your song is the song that I got married to? Or
yeah, I've had song. That.
Yeah,
I have had that.
That's quite, I mean, that's a huge responsibility.
Yeah, it's beautiful, man. I mean, it's a big responsibility. And I just, you know, especially if they've kind of misinterpreted the song.
Yeah. You wrote it about, you know, Winston from 1984, but they thought it was all about their love for their wife.
Yeah. But, you know, you let them have it, man. So it's a beautiful thing, man. I mean, I just feel gratitude. And, you know, as I said, you know, I think we couldn't have asked for a more joyous celebration for my dad. I think he would still be playing. I think, if it wasn't for the situation.
He's got piles of energy, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure he was exhausted after the tour that you guys have just done, but he didn't let that show on stage.
No. No, he's incredible, man. And he's been through so much, dude. You can't even believe it. Like,
I was talking to a friend of mine on Friday about it. And, you know, it's the fact that I'm still talking about it a week later.
Yeah.
That's usually the concert you kind of forget within a day.
I mean,
and I was showing her, you know, how he was doing those massive kicks and thing. And I tore my pants, yeah. I had to go borrow a pair of shorts from a brother.
That's an achievement. It was quite something.
Yeah, I know, it was horrendous. I was worried my balls would fall out.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So having seen the energy, and I mean, you've got that energy too.
I hope so.
I think
I'm 65, man, I hope I do.
And you know what? Let him have the privilege of being able to, as I said, tie a little bow around.
Because absolutely,
so many musicians, they don't get to either see themselves played out the way that he has.
Yeah.
And you know what? Whatever happens here happens. Yeah. I think he's making the right decision by leaving it at the top and leaving on a big high.
Yeah.
And to see that place packed out on Saturday with all these people who just come to see him. Mm. Really, the rest of you were a bonus.
Yeah. I know. And we weren't even on the lineup, you know, it was just for him. And it's great, man. I mean, you know, for me, it's bittersweet because I just know that we never anticipated it to happen,
sure.
But I don't think any artist in South Africa has ever had such an incredible send off, such an incredible tribute paid to them. And,
I mean, you read about sort of,
and it's deserved, man. I must say, you know, it's really truly deserved, in my opinion.
Absolutely. No, I was just thinking, you read these horrible stories about like how a singer from some band in the 1980s, she doesn't even have money to, you know, pay her hospital bills, and then you kind of see that send off, and you think, well, that's how it should be for people we love. It's right.
And I think that also comes down to just discipline, man. Like, you know, it's 35 years, 24 albums, years and years and years of touring, you know, so I hope to be as hardworking and as disciplined, you know, it's something to aspire to.
I want to talk about some of your songs.
Okay.
Use Me. Mm. So since you put so much thought and you're a literature student into your songs, what is Use Me all about? And then I want to know about Souvenir and Breathing just now.
Okay. So Use Me and Souvenir are actually very closely linked as songs. I wrote them on the same day.
Oh, wow. They just came to you.
Yeah. There's some songs that you write that are very considered where you actually want to write, you know, a very sort of, conscious dialogue or a narrative or something. And there's some that just kind of are expressions of a moment that you feel. You write the song in 5 minutes, the whole thing just comes out. And those two songs were songs like that. And I think both of them, in a way, deal with the sort of duality of love. Use Me specifically is about someone who is in a relationship that is inspiring and intriguing, but also has a darkness. And this person knows that he can't help himself but go down this road, and he knows it's going to end in some kind of chaos or trauma or whatever. But it's, you know, enticed by that. In a way, it's like this kind of,
like a toxic, magnetism.
Almost just to experience it, to know what it is, you know, to learn about it.
Have you had experiences like that in relationships?
I have, yeah. I certainly have.
What, dangerous women?
Not dangerous, but you know, I think it's more on an emotional level. Like you know, you're getting pulled into this place where you are not yourself, and you are kind of disintegrating, and you are,
Is that because you're just so in love? And I'm not asking about a particular one.
Yeah, potentially. I think that's part of it, but maybe you're also being manipulated. Maybe you're also being influenced to go down a dark road. You know, there's baggage that comes with that love that, that can harm you, and you recognize that. So I think that song is about that sort of duality. I think that it exists in all relationships, actually.
Yeah, but it sounds like you've got a very healthy handle on it. So I can't imagine.
I've had some wild times.
Have you found yourself abused? I mean, not physically abused, but have you found yourself being manipulated?
Yeah, I have. You know, I think.
What, you were just so in love you didn't see it?
Yeah, an aspect of that. And also insecure, you know, that your own insecurities in yourself kind of make you subservient or dependent. And then if the person is exploitative or is just someone who puts themselves through bad things, then you kind of
almost
go
like
on that
self-harm.
Yeah, you go on that trip with them, and it becomes a becomes a dark little ride.
Well, they say no relationship is perfect. So this happens.
But I think that, look, that's an extreme case. But I think in every relationship there is a push and pull. There's a tension. You know, there's always that tension. That's kind of what keeps it going. You know, so relationships are not simple. You know, there's a dark side that actually is very good for the relationship as well. So I think that
just explain that. Like a dark side that is good for the relationship. You mean a bit of mystery?
There's a power dynamic. There's a power play. There's always a push and pull. There's always an ownership quality. You know, there's all these layers that play into how people are in love.
Yeah.
You know, and there's compromise and there's surrender. So I think that it's trying to investigate how that, you know, those many layers of relationships and love work.
Yeah, it sounds like you should have dated much stupider girl. You would have had much less trouble.
And you know, it's funny, you know, when you write, you don't think about what you're writing. It just comes out, and then you have to try and analyze it afterwards to explain it in interviews.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know.
No, sorry, I'm dredging this up. That was a reprimand.
It's not, you know, it's weird. Like I'm actually in a very good relationship, to be honest. My girlfriend's going to kill me. I'm, you know, but.
This is a previous one.
Yeah. Don't worry about it.
You don't have to mention name. All right. So you said it was linked to Souvenir. You wrote them both on the same day. So how's that one different?
So Souvenir is less about that ambiguity and more about just full blown darkness, baby.
All right.
Being treated like you're a souvenir, like you're being exploited, like, you are bound, you're chained up by this person and, you trying to escape. You know, there's the lyrics, let me out, I can't breathe in here, all you need from me is I'm your souvenir.
Wow.
And so yeah, that's a darker kind of evaluation of the same perspective.
This is what happens when you grow up with too much Nirvana.
Yeah. The funny thing is I don't even listen to Nirvana anymore, but it was such a big part of my life.
But I'm so happy because today I found my friends in my head. That is such a song. Totally undervalued.
Everybody
always talks about, you know, Smells Like Teenage Spirit and all that stuff, but that Lithium,
that third album, In Utero, brilliant album, man.
All right, so tell me about Breathing.
Breathing is a song about hope, about just keeping your eyes on the horizon, keeping positivity in your life, no matter how challenging things get, relying on each other.
Did this have to do with kind of your dad and his health?
I think perhaps, you know, it wasn't something that I specifically wrote about this.
But were you going through it at the time?
I was going through it at the time, and you know, I guess I was. It was something that I drew on in myself to just stay positive, you know, and just to keep your eyes on the bigger picture, have some perspective, you know. Everyone faces these things at some point in life, and you know, you have to give yourself a chance. So I think that song is nice and optimistic.
Yeah, and Shekinah and DJ Kent and all of that in terms of collaboration.
Yeah.
You know.
Actually the original was just with Shekinah.
Right.
I literally just phoned her and I was like, hey man, love your voice. Do you want to come and do a song with me? And literally the next day we were in studio.
How does this work for us pedestrians who just, you know, hear your song? Do you get her number from a friend? Do you just phone her out of the blue and say, hey, it's Jesse Clegg? And she goes, oh, hey, Jesse.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
How does that work?
I don't know. I mean, I guess there's just
remember?
This, like, yeah.
Did you have someone...
I had a friend who knew a friend of her or something. I think someone at my agency.
Yeah.
And I was in the States and I heard one of her songs and I came back and I had the song Breathing. The original version was just me. I sang the whole song. And then I just phoned her and I was like, listen, I've got this song and I think that it would be great. And maybe there's like this unwritten kind of code between musicians. Like, you know, you can call each other up and ask each other if you want a collab. I think that's part of the vibe, you know? Maybe I'm just weird. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, when I get calls from other people in the entertainment business, I always know they're going to ask for something.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh no, what do you want?
Well, sometimes you, sometimes you take those calls, sometimes you don't, I guess.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that turned out to go quite well, though.
Yeah, it was great, man. I mean,
so it's an inspired decision.
Yeah. I mean, the same was
and you didn't have any issues about sharing your song.
Not at all, man. I mean, I love that. You know, it was the same with DJ Kent. You know, we met up in London. We were doing a show 2 years ago on some festival in London, mm-hmm. and we met backstage and he said he wanted to do something with me. And I didn't hear from him for 2 years and then suddenly got a call and he was like, let's do a song. And then it was that Kent Phonics song, I'll Follow You, which was a massive hit. So it was, you know, that's the great thing about music. You know, you can just run into guys and if they have the same sort of like-minded approach to music and they dig what you do and you dig what they do, man, the possibilities are endless. This collab thing is, I mean, I've only just started doing it, but it's awesome. I really enjoy it.
Do you enjoy doing these interviews or do you find it taxing?
I enjoy doing intelligent interviews. I'm enjoying this interview.
Okay, well, that's a relief. Would you prefer, though, to be in the studio recording now? You could be honest. You won't hurt my feelings.
No, I would prefer to be at home. just relaxing, to be honest.
Are you,
right
yeah,
now.
Look, I mean, you speak preaching to the choir here. I don't like to leave my house.
Yeah, me neither.
Happy there.
I travel so much, dude. When I'm at home, that is holidays for me.
Yeah.
Like I mean, I've just moved into a new place this year. I don't think I've been there for more than 2 weeks at a time.
And now you're about to go on this big tour of South Africa.
Yeah. So it's the
so
traveling.
Tell me about this. What's the plan? What's the route map?
Every December we do this tour. It's like basically a national tour of South Africa. It's an acoustic tour.
Right.
And it's really just a cool opportunity to go and visit a lot of the towns that, you know, you don't usually get to play during the year, during festival season and all that stuff.
Right, so is this every day of December or do you take a couple of days here and there?
We start on the 14th. Yeah. And we end on the 9th, I think.
Okay.
And it's basically 5 gigs a week.
Oh, my God.
And
exhausting?
It's exhausting. But it's also, it's a really fun month. You know, you get to kind of travel through all these different towns in South Africa. You know, Knysna, Plett, Cape Town, Mossel Bay, PE.
How many years in a row now?
This tour? We've done this. This is our fourth time doing
it. Okay, so now you've picked up on different things about different places. So what's the best place to go and admit to me which the shittest is?
Have you ever been to Morgan's Bay?
No.
Dude, that is an incredible place.
Why?
It's near East London.
What happens there?
Hour or so.
Are there even people?
Dude, it's like Plett was 10 years ago. It is like this very quiet but insanely beautiful place with the most incredible beaches I've ever seen in the world. Like there are beaches as far as the eye can see and there's literally one hotel.
Why hasn't it been ruined yet?
I think it's on the way. Like every year I've gone there, there's been like little malls opening up.
Why haven't they come and destroyed it? These greedy capitalists. And which one's the worst of your stops? Or not necessarily.
Geez, I can't say that.
Let's say the most challenging. No, because there's going to be some place that you're going, oh, God, no, really? Do we have to play there?
Oh, man, let me think. Okay, I'll give you one that we're not playing on this tour.
you're very diplomatic.
We went to, you know, whenever you do these long tours and there's a long drive, you have to do like 10 hours. You sometimes break it up with a show in the middle, which sometimes is in the most random town you can imagine. So, man, we did a show last year in a town. We did two. We did one in Prince Albert, which is
in the Karoo.
Yeah, we did one there. They actually have a very nice theater there, but it is the middle of nowhere.
Did people come?
We actually sold it out. I couldn't even believe it.
All right. But it's just like some dusty.
Yeah, it's just a dusty place in the middle of nowhere. And there's like one road and this brand new theater, which is like a 500 seater, like beautiful theater in the middle of nowhere. Like it's so random. And then
we
did Napier the 1 year.
I don't even know where it is.
It's somewhere in the Western Cape, but it's in literally the middle of nowhere. We were playing to people sitting on haystacks.
Yeah, that's when you know.
And the cops shut the gig down because it was supposedly a residential area. They didn't even have a venue. So we played to like 300, 400 people on haystacks. And I mean, bad. The whole town turned up. Yeah, and it was sure. Actually, it was very sweet.
In fact, they're still talking about you. It's the last time they saw any people from out of town. So now they're waiting. They're waiting. Tumbleweeds are rolling by. Yeah. Maybe he'll come back. You're like their Jesus.
Yeah, it was impressive, man.
Wow,
but so you
right.
get to play like, I mean, it's literally like 25 gigs in a row. You play places that you would never think to play. And, you know, you play all the usuals, Cape Town, Durban, PE, East London, all the big towns.
Do you take your girlfriend with you on these things, or do you leave her at home because it's too much?
Well, she's working, but when she gets off, she'll join us.
Okay. So she'll fly in and just like be there for the one or the two.
Yeah, she'll
come. Because also,
like,
it's work for you, right? So it's not like you've got...
Yeah, it is work. Yeah. It's hard work. I mean, we travel with the whole production now. So we've got the Jesse Clegg bus.
Yeah.
And a one-ton trailer. We've got the full production. We've got a lighting rig. Got our tech crew, musicians, and the engineer. We all travel in a bus.
Wow.
So we do... You know, we can do 15,000 kilometers just in December.
And you're paying all these people.
Paying them, man.
Yeah. Got bills.
Yeah, got bills to pay.
It's a lot of work.
So we got to sell tickets.
Sure. Okay, well, I mean, if anybody goes to Napier, they're going to miss out on you this year. But,
yeah, sorry,
but
guys.
The rest of the coast, they've got you covered.
Yeah. So all the tickets are on jesseclegg.com. We're doing a acoustic show, doing some new songs, which is going to be exciting. And all the oldies and the latest album.
Do you do covers?
Not really.
Yeah, you see, you're a purist.
Yeah, I do one song that is not really a cover. It's like a traditional blues song. It's been done by many artists. It's called Cinnamon, and it's been done by Nina Simone. It's been done by, I think it was even done by Prince at one point. There's been DJ versions of it. It's like a traditional. But
okay.
We do our own version of it, and it's a very bizarre, weird song, but it's very cool.
Right. Is there a reason you won't do other covers? Just because you don't want people to think you're a cover artist?
I enjoy doing covers, but, you know, I think, I don't know, I guess.
Have you ever heard someone else's song and been so jealous that it wasn't your song that you needed to do a cover?
I have had that, but for me, like... I mean, I've definitely had that. I've been annoyed by that.
Yeah. Must be annoying.
Yeah. But it also kind of makes you want to write a song like that. So you kind of start like, kind of take some ideas, you kind of sprinkle it on. And
well,
you,
imagine
you know.
My pain. I hear that all the time and I can't write a song. At least you can write songs.
Yeah, exactly.
Much worse being me. I have no outlet for that. All you have is the jealousy.
Yeah. You can tweet it, man. Tweet your anger.
Oh, yeah. Sure. That's going to help. Oh, man. Listen, this crap about you walking around with your Shazam open all day, that's not true. That's PR, right? You don't have it open all the time.
I mean, I do have it open sometimes. I enjoy
it. It says here, he walks around with his Shazam open all day long when traveling to discover new types of music.
Well, it's the first I've heard of that, but
very deep research.
That's deep, man. I mean, I have Shazammed in my life. It's so funny. Like, I very rarely discover a new artist that I love, unless when I'm on tour. Like, when I'm on tour, I just suddenly just my ears prick up. Like, I hear these artists all the time, especially in the States. Like, I come home with all these new albums that I'm so psyched about.
This is a bit of a family talent too, because you know your dad heard different things, and then he would incorporate those into his stuff. And stuff that people wouldn't necessarily think goes together. He might go together. So obviously you have an ear for this.
Yeah. I've been criticized for just jumping around too much genre-wise, you know.
Is it a nightmare to produce your stuff?
Because I'm so hands-on, I think, you know. I like so many different types of music.
How do you know
music.
When it's done?
I mean, it's never done. You know it's done when the deadline hits you, you know. It's like...
Yeah. Because you could sit in the studio forever, right?
Yeah.
Bit of a perfectionist.
Absolutely. I mean, Souvenir, that song, I mean, you can ask Denim about it. It literally took us 6 months to record and mix that song. Just that song. We were all going crazy.
You wrote it in one day, and then it took you that long to produce.
It was an instant write, and then to record it that was an absolute nightmare.
How many times did you throw everything out and start again?
I think I've got on my computer about 22, 23 versions of that song.
Sure.
And full mixes of it, final mixes, and then start again. So, yeah, Denim always jokes with me, my producer. He's like, so when are we remixing Souvenir, dude? Are you free tomorrow?
Do you have the the melody pops into your head first? The what is it? What comes in first when you have these songs just occur to you?
I think it's a concept first, or it's a feeling. You know, sometimes you in a headspace, maybe a happy headspace or a dark headspace or whatever, and then you just write a series of ideas. You know, I usually start on guitar and I'll find a chord progression that excites me, and then you start, you know, kind of mumbling over it, finding a melody, and then the emotions of the music and the melody sort of suggests lyrics. It's very organic, and it's not good to kind of overthink it. I think the key to it is to be playful and to be curious. Like, for me, creativity is playful curiosity. Being able to just...
Are there songs that are just going round and round in your head that you haven't yet been able to figure
out?
Like, there's ideas floating.
Yeah,
out,
there's
little
chord
pieces.
Progressions that whenever I pick up a guitar, I play it and I'm like, man, I really want to write something over
this.
Yeah,
this has got to go somewhere.
Yeah, it's like scratching an itch and you're like, where can this go? You know, and that thought process, as long as you don't pressurize yourself, as long as you're not self-conscious and you truly curious about where can this go, you know, let me see where I can take this. Let me try these bunch of notes and this kind of lyric and play over this. And you know, you can write your best music sitting in front of a TV on the couch, completely relaxed and just having a playful little interaction with your instrument. You know, that is when you're at your most creative, because you are totally relaxed. You're just letting it flow.
Who do you take it to first? I mean, if you've got an idea, do you go to Denim?
I do sometimes go to Denim. I sometimes go to my manager. You know, you always play it for your girlfriend or your friends.
Sure.
You know, the first line of defense is, you know, you play for your girlfriend or you play for your
someone
family.
You know doesn't have ulterior motives.
Yeah. And you try get feedback, and usually it's just like, yeah, it's nice, or nah, I don't like it. And because it's not fleshed out, it's just basically you wailing on an out of tune guitar. Yeah.
But honest feedback, that's hard to find.
Yeah. It's hard to find feedback that is, it's hard to ask someone who's not a musician for constructive feedback. You know what I mean? So you can play someone a song and they can say, I like it. And then you say, okay, what do you like about it? Like, do you like this part? Is this too short? Is this too long? Like, how can we extend? Like, you know, so because you're in the process of writing, and this person's just like, I don't know why I like it. I just like it. so that's frustrating. You know, that's why eventually when I've got something that I know everyone who hears it is kind of like, yeah, I like this. This is cool. Then I'll go to Denim, or I'll go to my management, or I'll go to people that I respect, and we'll start finding the way to make it amazing.
When did you burn your hand?
Last tour in July.
So what did you do?
Man,
what happened?
It was the first show of the tour. We had 8 shows over that period.
It's like when Michael Jackson got his hair on fire in the Pepsi commercial.
It was so random. So we were playing in PE. We played the show, and the techs packed the car and everything. And we were driving out, and it was like midnight.
Yeah.
And I could feel that the car was dragging. I wasn't driving. I was sitting in the passenger seat, but I could feel that the car was dragging. And I was like, hang on, stop. You know, cause everyone is playing music and everyone's like having a jaw. And I could feel there was something weird going on with the car. So I said, stop the car. I got out and I walked around to the trailer, and I could see that there's a brake that holds the wheel.
Shit.
It's a chain.
Yeah.
And the chain hadn't been put back, so it was under the wheel.
Ah.
And it was basically kind of pulling the whole structure towards the wheel. So I tried to pull the chain out, and the chain was burning hot. It was like literally, it was like melting. It was so hot. So I grabbed it to pull it out, and I burnt my hand. And I
badly?
Not too badly. It was quite tough to play. I had to bandage it for...
Again?
I mean, I had gigs for the rest of the week, so I just bandaged it, and I kind of found a way to strum around it. But, I mean, I had to go to the hospital, and it was crap because it was the first show of the tour.
Are you nervous about your voice and everything? You've got that insured. Are you careful not to talk too much during the day? You've got a show that night.
Look, if I'm on a long tour, I mean, you know, last year when I did 2 months in the States, and it was tons of traveling. Then, you have to be careful. You can't have late nights. Sleep is really important.
And talking is worse than singing.
Yeah, talking is also not good. And also smoking, drinking, acidic food, all that stuff. You know, it's annoying though. I mean, I hate singers who are like so conscious about their voice. You know, so I try not to be, but if there's a long haul, I'll be conscious of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, don't lose the voice. We have to go back to literature.
Yeah.
Horrible.
To writing, yeah.
You were at South by Southwest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was awesome, man.
It was cool.
It was, you were also there. I messaged you, I remember. It's not really a great music festival anymore. It's more of an IT festival. It's like a tech festival.
And the music that they do have there is so carefully selected now.
Yeah,
so
there's too much, I think. They oversell it. There's too many bands. There's too many people at the festivals. I mean, standing in those queues, you have the artist VIP pass and you're standing in queues.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
But Americans love to queue.
They love it.
They don't have any problem
queuing. I don't know why.
Here in South Africa, we get in a temper if we see a queue of 10 people.
Yeah,
in America, they can't wait to get to number 1,101 on the queue.
Yeah.
They're okay with it. Yeah. It blows my mind.
It's weird. I mean, I don't get it.
Obedient.
Yeah.
There's no queue jumping or any of that stuff there.
Yeah.
Here, we would all be trying to jump to the front.
It's a cultural thing. I remember at South By, like, there was a queue for the Roots. There's two queues. So there's the main queue and then there's the VIP queue.
Mm-hmm.
The VIP queue was like 2 blocks long.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I'm not even going to attempt to watch this band. And I was like, that's probably the longest queue I'm going to see at the festival. Mm-hmm. And then the next day they had the Nintendo Switch launch. And that was like the entire of Austin came out to see that. And it just kind of made me think, like, this is what music is actually competing with in reality as an industry. You know, we're not, it's not like the 70s and 80s and 90s where, you know, people would sit in their lounge and listen to music as an activity in and of itself. You would sit and listen to a vinyl, to a new album and discuss it.
Mm.
Now music has become this.
It's an option. Like,
yeah.
Like apps.
And it's secondary. Like it's not a primary form of entertainment anymore. Yeah. It's secondary. It's in the background of a film, or it's in a video game, or it's at a party. It's in the background, you know. Video games, you sit and you play. That's your entertainment, you know. And music has a lot to compete with. The industry's changed. And, you know, going to that South By festival, it was kind of, it was exciting in a lot of ways, but it was also, a little bit depressing. Cause I saw that suddenly now the video game side of that festival has now become far more, important culturally, I guess, to the music side. South By used to be this really, really authentic place for new artists to go and expose themselves to people.
Write some songs for video games.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's where it's going. You know, that's how it is.
I know. It's going to be all right.
Hope
well,
so.
I don't think you have to worry, man. The stuff that you've already done is superb, and the stuff that I'm sure that you've got planned is going to be even better. And, you know, things like this tour, you can have huge support out there.
Yeah,
people love what you do, so keep doing it.
Yeah, no, I'm psyched. I'm very grateful and I'm lucky.
And you work hard.
I work hard. This year has been hard.
Yeah.
Well, but I'm psyched, man. It's going to be a great tour.
Take a few days to just chill.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. And, you can get tickets at jesseclegg.com.
There we go.
And we are literally in almost every coastal town. So if you're going to any of the major sort of holiday destinations.
Right.
I will see you there.
We'll make a special effort to go to Morgan's Bay, which sounds really good. And
it's really cool. And we're playing at the only hotel in Morgan's Bay.
Right.
And they have this really awesome sort of conference area at the bottom on the beach.
Beautiful.
So come and check it out. It's a great place.
All right, Jesse. Thank you, man. It's good to see you again.
Thank you so much, man.
And we will keep in touch, and we'll make sure that we get any updates when you're ready to surprise us with something new, because you've got to keep doing new stuff, and you certainly do.
I'm going to start writing early next year, so very soon.
Right, and give us your thesis on the origin of species.
Okay. I'll email it to you. It's going to take you an hour to read the...
It's worth it. That's fascinating. All right, we've learned a lot that we didn't know about you in this discussion, and I'm sure there's still a whole lot more. And we'll keep an eye on you.
Thank you, man.
Thanks, dude.
Really appreciate it.
Nice to see you.
Likewise. CliffCentral.com.